evening we have the ultimate questions. Is that on? Yeah. The ultimate questions. Right, a lot of ultimate questions today. Here we go, the first one. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between Arahat, Bodhisattva and Buddha? Thanks. What is the difference between Arahat, Bodhisattva and Buddha? First of all, a Bodhisattva is some being who will become a Buddha. Now, that's a very controversial point, which sometimes separates the Mahayana, the Theravada, the Vajrayana, and the one which I really support, the Hahayana. There, you're all Hahayana practitioners. Because this is a very interesting point. There is one very fascinating sutra. It's called the Gatikara Sutra. And it's also in the Chinese Agamas as well, so this is a very authentic teaching of the Buddha. And the Gatikara Sutra goes like this. Gatikara was a potter in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. Now, all Buddhist traditions realize there's been many, many Buddhas. The one of our era is Siddhartha Gautama, and this is the previous one. And Gatikara, it's actually the Buddha told a story to Ananda. He was saying, oh, once upon a time, there was this potter called Gatikara in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. And Gatikara was just a staunch supporter of Kassapa the Buddha. But the only reason he could not become a monk was because his two parents were blind and had no one else to look after them. So he had to look after his mum and dad, but he really would love to become a monk. And actually, he was an anagami, that's a non-returner, just basically almost fully enlightened. You know, if you hang around a Buddha long enough, you'd expect to get something. And he was, he was an anagami, a non-returner. So he had a best friend called Jyotipala. And Jyotipala, he was one of these people like you have today. Doesn't want anything to do with religion. All these monks are lazy, good-for-nothing bums. They should just go and get a proper job and take responsibility and do all this sort of stuff. Because Gatikara was always trying to get his best mate, Jyotipala, to go and see Kassapa the Buddha. And Jyotipala kept on calling Kassapa the Buddha, basically a shaven-headed good-for-nothing. And basically that's what he said many times. And Gatikara tried and tried and tried. Eventually he tricked his best friend Jyotipala to go and see Kassapa the Buddha. And when Jyotipala actually met Kassapa the Buddha and heard some teachings, Jyotipala was rapt. And he became a Buddhist. More than that, actually Jyotipala, his parents were okay, so Jyotipala actually became a monk. And he actually ordained as a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. And the story goes off on another tangent about Gatikara. But at the end of that sutra, the Buddha tells Ananda, I was Jyotipala in a previous life. And Gatikara was my best friend in that life. So there we have the Buddha, our Buddha, saying in a previous life he was a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha, a monk under Kassapa the Buddha, and also, interestingly, before he met Kassapa the Buddha, he really bad-mouthed, abused, and criticized the Buddha. Now that gives you an idea of someone who's about to be a Buddha, and that's a very recent life, because in all Kassapa, everyone agrees that was this eon. So that's actually in the whole of many, many eons of existence. That's actually pretty recent. Almost at the end of the career of Siddhartha Gautama, almost about to be a Buddha. And some people, and I think there's lots of evidence to support this, think that that was Siddhartha Gautama's previous human life. But the interesting thing was, he was critical of the Buddha. He couldn't even recognize the Buddha. Number two, interestingly, you can have a read of that sutra, Majjhimanikaya. The other interesting thing is, imagine that you are someone with all of these great sort of spiritual qualities, and you ordained a monk under a Buddha. You think that you get something being actually a monk. At the very least, you'd be a stream winner, wouldn't you? Once returner? You couldn't be a non-returner because that person, Jyotipala, came back as Siddhartha Gautama. But, number one, suppose he was, say, a once returner under Kassapa the Buddha. Then they say that once returners, for the most part, get reborn in the Tusita realm. And in another place, our Buddha says that he was in the Tusita realm, and there he got reborn into this human realm. And according to the story which was told by Ananda, so he said, Ananda was of the same family, he said, when the Buddha was born, our Buddha was born, he said, this is my last life. And how would he have been able to know that? With impermanence, uncertainty, unless he really was a once returner. So there's a lot of evidence, and actually there was a lot of people even early on thought that yes, Siddhartha Gautama was born as a once returner because of his experience under Kassapa the Buddha. And then practice, 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 and finally made it all the way to being fully enlightened and thereby qualified as the Buddha, the first enlightened being of this era. Now something else, actually, after his enlightenment, this is in the Sanyutta Nikaya, there was many many devas came to pay respects to the newly enlightened Siddhartha Gautama. And one of those who came to pay respect was Gatikara. And Gatikara in the poem, it's in the Deva Putta Sanyutta. Gatikara, who obviously he died just like Jyotipala passed away, and he, because he was a non-returner, Anagami, he gets reborn in the Sudhavasa, the pure abodes. And you hang out there for eons and eons, not eons, but for many, many sort of hundreds, thousands of years. And so when he sort of saw his old friend Jyotipala, now Siddhartha Gautama, you know, become enlightened, of course he came around to say, congratulations. And that's there. You see, in the Gatikara Sanyutta, well, Devaputta Sanyutta, the Gatikara Sutta in the Devaputta Sanyutta, you see the Gatikara coming down to the newly enlightened Gautama Buddha and saying, well done, we used to be in the same village in a previous life under Kassapa the Buddha. I was called Gatikara, you were called Jyotipala, and now you've become a Buddha. Congratulations. Supporting evidence. So, the interesting part of that is maybe our Buddha, when he was first born, was already sort of well on the way, was a once returner. Number two, there you see beforehand, in his life under Kassapa the Buddha, early on as Jyotipala, he was not wise at all. He obviously has some qualities, but could not even recognize a Buddha. So in that type of Buddhism, you think a bodhisattva is only really sort of getting wise, getting sort of close to some idea of enlightenment, very near to the end of his whole series of lives. And you can't say that a bodhisattva who's going to be enlightened in the next eon or something, or 10 eons from now, is wise. You can't say that, because we have an example of a bodhisattva talked about by the Buddha who was basically stupid. And the Buddha was talking about himself in sort of a previous life. And that's very interesting, because sometimes these days we think bodhisattvas are all wise and all powerful, but there you see they were actually stupid. So that's a bodhisattva. And I also mentioned like a Buddha. And the Buddha is, as it were, the first enlightened being when there's no other Dharma around. So the Buddhism, the Dharma, the path, the Eightfold Path has all been lost. And the person arises, they become enlightened, and they teach the path. They teach the path, they reveal it when it's been lost. That is the definition of a Buddha. And after there's a Buddha, many other people become enlightened, and people become enlightened after the Buddha. Now when Buddhism is being taught, when it's the Eightfold Path is known, that's called an arahat. There we go. So now you know the difference between an arahat, a bodhisattva, and a Buddha. Anyone got any questions about that one? It's not the usual definition, but remember in Buddhism you question, you argue, you interpret, and you have full freedom to do that, and you have full freedom to argue with me, and I'll argue back. Yes. Now, you thought it was Prince Witantra because you're a Thai and you've been brought up with that ever since you were very small. But those are 10 Jatakas, which Witantra is the last one, are very, very late. They're not part of early Buddhism. They're not even in the core Jatakas. They're actually afterwards. Because what happened later on in the history of Buddhism, we got this idea of parami or paramitas. And actually that came from Mahayana. They invented, or they started the paramita. They had 6 paramitas. And so later on, the Theravada, we caught up. But we always have to do one better. Actually, 4 better. We had 10 paramitas. You know, just, we're better than you are. And there is a lot of that in some of the scholars, you know. So, but once you had 10 paramitas, and that was maybe about, must have been at least 300, 400 years after the Parinirvana of the Buddha, then they had the stories of the Buddha actually perfecting those paramitas. So those actually 10 Jatakas where the Buddha perfected each of these last 10 paramitas, they are certainly late. They're called apocryphal. So they're really not authentic. And especially when you compare it to actually what's in the oldest part of the Buddhist canon, you know, the sutras. And there you've got the Gatikara Sutra. You read that and that, wow, that makes really a lot of sense. Yeah.
Sorry, what was
the
Buddha's name in that previous one?
Jyotipala.
Could you not argue, though, that you said that he was stupid, like he couldn't recognize the Buddha?
Yeah.
But if Jyotipala was obviously resisting meeting the Buddha, that, but as soon as he saw him,
yeah.
Obviously the recognition was there.
Yeah.
So, and he's not enlightened yet, so he hasn't got that sort of psychic power to be able to
see
through his friends.
Yeah.
So couldn't you argue that the wisdom's all there just latent for the...
I agree with you there. The wisdom's all there just latent, just like his wisdom's in you, latent.
Oh.
So... but I can still call people stupid, because they're not looking at it yet, they're looking at something else. But the point was that he did, Jyotipala, he did verbally abuse Kassapa many times. So you think that if a bodhisattva, very close to their final life, that was wise and was sharp, they would at least never do that. Yeah. Indeed, yes, a great question. If somebody was a stream winner or a once returner in a previous life, and then they go and get reborn in some heaven realm, have a bit of a rest or whatever, play around, then they come back to this life, are they a stream winner? Are they a once returner? When they start talking as a baby, do they start talking about Four Noble Truths and depend on the information of everybody? And of course the answer is no. Because usually what happens is, when you're born, there's a special being. And sometimes there are beings who have spoken when they were born. There's many stories about that, but I won't get into that this evening. Many of you know those stories. But, you know, they'll be very, very wise, and obviously very sort of special babies, but then you tend to forget afterwards. What actually says in the sutras is some beings, they enter the mother's womb with mindfulness, and also mindfulness also means memory, what they're doing, where they come from. They remain in the womb with mindfulness, and they emerge with mindfulness. In other words, these are very, very developed beings. But after emerging from the womb with mindfulness, you know exactly where you've been and where you come from and what you're up to. But then you lose it in the years just afterwards. It's as if, you know, your mind is very pure and very wise, but it's living in a body, which is a baby's body. And that baby's body, and its brain, its sort of metabolism, whatever, takes over and clouds that memory. and you become a baby again. You're just an ordinary baby, although with a very sort of good qualities, not sort of a naughty scallywag baby. And then as you grow up, you'll obviously be inclining towards Buddhism or Dharma or meditation or whatever. There'll be a sort of an attraction there. And then one day you will have to re-experience, you know, the seeing of the Dharma. You'll see it again. And it's like you've just been experiencing a stream when I once return it again. And then from that point you can carry on where you left off. Yes. Can you make an affirmation, want to be a Buddhist next time when you die? That's more controlling, more doing. Because you will naturally. Because this is where you're leaning. What it says in the sutras is if a tree is leaning to the south, then when it dies, you know, when it falls over or there's a storm or something, it will fall to the south. If it's leaning to the right all its life, it'll fall to the right. So your inclinations, the whole thing of your life, if you've been a Buddhist, if you've been a meditator, you know, throughout the whole of this life, or at least in the last 10, 15, 20 years, of course you're going to be a Buddhist in the next life. You don't even need to make a resolution. It will happen naturally. The same as if you've been a scallywag. You know, just been messing around, doing nothing for anybody else, being selfish, ungenerous, cruel, mean. And if you just make a resolution at the end of your life, I will now become a Buddhist in my next life, or I will go to heaven. You can't do that. You know that story? This is a great story, but some of you heard it before. It was about this... I think it was actually, let's call it, because there's a few Sri Lankans here, from Colombo. There's a man from Colombo. And he never wanted to go to the temples because the priest always asked him to put money in the donation box. And that was a big turn-off, especially for a guy who was a business person. But nevertheless, his wife almost forced him to go, at least on Waisak, on the Buddha's birthday, enlightenment day, final passing away day. So he went to the temple, dragged there by his devout wife. And he had to hear this priest drone on with a sermon. But he actually was quite interested because the priest was actually saying about what happens when you die. And he said that when you die, if you have a really good thought in your mind when you die, you get a good rebirth, maybe even a heaven realm. The last thought is crucial to your rebirth, which is classic Buddhism. And the priest said that one of the best thoughts you can have when you die is to think of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, the triple gem. And he said, it doesn't matter so what you've done the rest of your life, if you think of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha when you die, you're certain to go to heaven and get a really beautiful rebirth. And so this businessman started thinking, that's what I need to do. Just wait till I die and then think of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's brilliant! I don't have to keep stupid five precepts. I don't have to go and give up my drink, my alcohol. I don't have to go to the temple. I don't have to give donations. All I have to do is to think, when I die, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and I go to heaven. But then he thought, how can I make sure I do that? And then he thought for a while. He was actually a very intelligent guy. He was a genius. He thought of a fail-safe way of thinking about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha when he dies. Because he had three sons. So, when he got home, he renamed them. The eldest son he renamed Buddha, second son Dharma, third Sangha, because he knew what happens when you're in hospital, when you're about to die, you have your children around you. So that was it. So he sussed it all out. He was beating the system, as the guy who told me this story first of all said. He was sure to go to heaven, without having to do any sort of good karma or sort of mess up his enjoyment of life. So, years went past, and then he got old, he got sick, and finally, of course, it was his last illness. And everything was going according to plan. There was, by his bedside, he was croaking, about to die, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, his three sons, And so he kept looking at them, Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I'm going to go to heaven, for sure. Buddha Dhamma Sangha, Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And just before he died, he looked at them again, Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Then he suddenly thought, if my three sons are here, who's looking after my business? And that's when he died. So the point of the story is, you cannot beat the system. Sure, when you sort of, the last thought is very important, but your last thought, the determination, I'll be a Buddhist in my next life, or I will be whatever, that's a sum total of all that you've been before. Your whole inclinations. So you can't suddenly just say, because you've been, you know, really cruel or evil, you know, for the whole life, okay, I'll be good when I die. The last thought, you just can't do that. It's the same that I know that people over in Singapore and Malaysia, they really complain about these evangelical pastors. You know, if you've got sort of a son or a daughter who's, you know, one of these born-again Christians, you know, when their dad or their mum is on their deathbed, you know, they may be a Buddhist, they may be a Hindu, maybe a Muslim or whatever, but the daughter or son will bring the pastor to the bedside and they will harass, you know, the father or the mother until they convert to being a Christian. It's a gross thing. And so a lot of times people said, Ajahn Brahm, please give us some advice. What can we do to stop this happening? And I said, look, it's an easy solution. If that's your father or mother, tell them. If there's, you know, your sister or daughter is a crazy Christian, you know, there's evangelical ones, if they want to convert, you convert. And if I'm an old man, and I'm in the bed, and then my daughter or son wants to make me become a Christian, convert, and that makes them happy. And as soon as they're out of the room, you can convert back again to being a Buddhist. You can convert one way, you can convert the other. What's the point? And that really upset the Christians. So anyhow, so you can't convert in the last moment. If you've been a Buddhist all your life, okay, you can say you're Christian, you can say you follow the Great White Ram or whatever, but whatever you say you are, that's not going to stop who you are. So that deathbed conversions are just a complete waste of time. Because even if they never heard this, if, you know, somebody had been, say, a Hindu all their life, and on their deathbed was converted to be sort of a Christian, as soon as they die, they convert back again themselves. Because that's who they are, that's their inclination, that's what they are. You can't just think you can convert people by words. Anyway, dear Ajahn, have you met the Deva? Not a Deva. I have. Actually, when I look at all of you, you're all Devas in your next life because you're being good people and you're coming to this place. Sure, you're all Devas, so I've met you all. What sort of answer do you think you're going to get for the question like that? How can a yo-yo nimitta be stabilized? Oh, the yo-yo nimittas, these are the ones which come and go and come and go and come and go. So actually, how you stabilize them is, one, patience, and number two, just realizing that you're interfering with them. As if they're coming in, it's just like the story of Ajahn Chah, still forest pool, the animal's coming out, and it thinks there's somebody there, and it goes back again. It's obviously you haven't scared it all that much because it keeps coming back again. So you're almost there. You just have to be that little bit more still. That tiny bit less interfering. And calm down. And nimitta will stay. So when I talk very softly there, because that's actually what you've got to do. You've got to be very sensitive and very soft and very, very delicate. Because these are amazing things, these nimittas. So don't be sort of harsh and sort of coarse with the way you use your mind. You've got to be very, very delicate. Just like the same way I've seen some of these artists, you know, who are doing, say, touching up some of these great works of art. You know, because they're sort of restorers or something. And just one sort of false brush stroke, and you've ruined it. Or sometimes these heart surgeons, or brain surgeons, they got a knife inside your brain. And imagine just one lack of mothers. Oops. Now they could be that mindful and that careful, that sensitive. So why can't you be sensitive with the nimitus? It is like brain surgery. But it's actually mind surgery, really. So you've got to be very, very delicate. And after a while, a bit of practice, you can do that. Dhyanajan, how will one know they have attained the final stage in Nibbana? Will the Buddha and Devas appear to honour him as an arahat? Nah, the Buddhas and arahats are all gone. They won't come and say hello. And sometimes it's a problem because sometimes people think they're an arahat, but they're not. So this is the problem. Sometimes when you do get great experiences, it's the job of teachers to test you out. That's why there's a story in my book, and it's a nice story because it's got a funny ending. And if you haven't read the story yet, here it comes. If you have read the story, here it comes anyway. There was once a young monk. I think it was in China, this story. And he was one of these people who was nothing's going to stand in the way of his enlightenment. He was going to go for broke. He wasn't interested in doing chanting or going to people's houses and blessing this and blessing that like I keep on doing. I bless everything these days, but nevertheless. He was just going to go and meditate, become enlightened in this life, and that was it. And so he had full commitment. But you know, in a monastery, sometimes there is a lot of things to do. So one day he went up to see his abbot and said, look, not far from here, there's a lake. And you know in the middle of that lake is an island. Can I please have permission to build a very simple hut there, a hermitage? Because I really want to go for broke in this lifetime, to really become enlightened. So I can live in that hermitage. And all you need to do, I'm sure it's easy for you to arrange, Abbot, is to get an attendant to row over to the island once a week with supplies. Just simple food. I don't need anything special, just simple food. So that I can sort of look after myself with no bother, with no worries at all, with no obstructions. So I really want to meditate and become enlightened. And the abbot, obviously, if a person is that dedicated, why not? So he built himself his little hermitage, very simple. And then every week, the attendant would go over, would give him some food, and if there's anything he needed, anything special, like toilet paper or toothbrush or whatever. Well, brush your teeth. They would actually bring it over the next week. And so this monk had been living in this hermitage for 3 years. And after 3 years, imagine just on retreat, but perfect situation and conditions for 3 whole years. After 3 years, he thought, yeah, I've done it. I'm enlightened. He really thought he was fully enlightened. So what do you do next once you're enlightened? So he thought, I'd better sort of go and tell my abbot the good news. So, the next time the attendant came over, bring some food, the monk asked the attendant, next week can you bring a quill, some ink, and some parchment? I want to write some calligraphy. And so a week later, the parchment, ink, and quill came. And the monk had 7 days. He meditated and made his mind very still in the bliss of enlightenment. And when he was ready, he wrote on the parchment with exquisite calligraphy. Now, the sort of stuff which would be on the walls of these Chinese temples. And their words read, the diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. The diligent monk alone for 3 years, no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. It was a verse in 4 lines. It was actually called Pada in the Buddhist way of having verse. And having 4 worldly winds, or not being moved, was actually one way of saying you're fully enlightened. So he rolled up the parchment and he gave it to the attendant to hand to the abbot. And then next week, he was just relaxing, trying to imagine what would happen next, thinking that now he's enlightened, and the abbot would see this parchment and realize his student was enlightened. He'd probably call him off the island so he could teach and help other sentient beings. In fact, he'd probably become an abbot himself, and maybe have a big temple, maybe in the city, and probably have all sorts of wealthy, rich people, kings, coming to learn how to be enlightened from him. So he was made. He'd made it. And the next week, the attendant brought the answer from the abbot. It looked like his parchment. And so he opened it. And when he read what the abbot had written on his parchment, his face went white, and his lips started to quiver. Because over his beautiful calligraphy, over the first line, the diligent monk, his abbot, in a red ballpoint pen, they didn't really have them in those days, but imagine something similar, has scrawled the four letters F-A-R-T. Fart. And the next line, hello, for 3 years. He written another fart, only in capital letters. And the third line is no longer moved. And it's a bigger F-A-R-T with an exclamation mark after it. By the four worldly winds. And there, you see, an enormous fart underlined with three exclamation marks over his exquisite calligraphy. It took him 3 years to get to be able to write this beautiful stuff, and that stupid abbot had just messed it all up just with red paint, red ink, and what were his crude things he was saying. And the diligent monk, he was not going to have this. He ran after that attendant, called him back, got in the boat and said, row me over to see that stupid abbot of mine. And he went to the monastery, stormed into the abbot's office, slammed the parchment on the table, banged his fist on the table, said, explain this, you stupid abbot. And so the abbot sort of calmly unrolled the parchment. And he looked at the monk, and then he looked at the parchment, and he just read it. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet, diligent monk, four little farts have blown you clean over the lake. And at that, the diligent monk realized he wasn't enlightened after all, and went back to the lake for another 3 years. That's an old sort of classical story. And it's true, somebody comes up and says they're fully enlightened. My job is to say, you stupid idiot, you're not enlightened. Someone like you. Or say, a woman can't become enlightened. That'd be a good one, yeah. If you get enlightened, if you get angry or not. So my job is to try and make you angry. And if you just sort of take the bait, you become angry, see, you're not enlightened. So sometimes that's what we have to do. So sometimes people think they're enlightened, but you know you really are enlightened. No greed or desire, no anger, no ill will, no fear. You're not afraid of things. Those are classic signs. But the easiest one is anger. Because not many people get angry because life is sometimes very frustrating. So if you have any thoughts of anger or any ideas of anger, then you're obviously not enlightened yet. Never mind. Give another try. Regarding jhanas and insight, when reflecting on or reviewing one's experience after coming out of jhanas, this is a form of thinking. Then how can it lead to enlightenment? What does one reflect on? I don't know if any of you have had a sort of a traumatic car accident. And if you have, sometimes you don't think about what happened, it just comes to you. You can't get it out of your head. Now the headlights coming towards you or the car turning or whatever, any trauma has an indelible imprint on the brain. The jhanas are like a trauma, but they're positive. They're just beautiful, wonderful. You just can't sort of ignore it. It sort of comes up to you because it's an intense experience. So you don't need to think about it. It just keeps returning to you. And the more you see it, the more you experience it, the more you understand it, that's where you get in mind. So it's almost, as I said, involuntary. You don't have to think, now I should reflect upon it. Had this most amazing experience of your life. Of course you reflect upon it. You can't avoid reflecting on it. It's just important. It's amazing. It's huge. So you don't need to think about it. It just comes to teach you. And aside from reviewing the experience, is there anything else you have to do? I've read that when the mind withdraws out of jhana, back into Upacara Samadhi, this is the most powerful mind for generating insight. So how is this done? Do you keep on meditating after reviewing the jhana or what? Completely natural process. So you don't do anything. And you can't do anything. After you come out of these jhanas, your mind is just so still and peaceful. It's hard to move it at all, to do any thinking. But there you have it right in front of you. And it's almost as if that you have all the information, just click. Ah, yes. See it. That's what it is. So you don't have to work hard. You're unable to work hard at that stage. Thank you so much for patiently teaching us, interviewing us, and answering all of our questions. I haven't done all of them yet, but I'm getting there. Are you tired? Yeah. But I'm happy being tired. If we all did a big group loving kindness meditation directed towards you, would it help top up your energy or just help you sleep well? Actually, if it tops up my energy, I don't sleep well. So maybe don't do loving kindness meditation and then I can get less energy and have a nice nap. Often we do not know what we can do in return for our teachers. Please share what are some of the things you appreciate most from your disciples. Okay, now that's a great question. There's only one thing which you can do for your teacher, and that's become enlightened. So again, for any teacher, you know that if you've had children, you know what the greatest gift your children can give you as a mother or father is to be happy. That's it. If your kids are happy, happy with themselves, happy with life, that's the best gift they can give to you. And if it's a teacher just wants to see their students doing well. So the best gift you can give to me is come up and say, Ajahn Brahm, this is so wonderful. I just had a jhana. This is a real jhana. I never thought it happened to me. And that's true, because sometimes people come up and say that, and that's my gift. And I think, oh, I'm really happy that someone else has got like a jhana. If they become enlightened or something, and say, oh, this is it. And then that's one of the greatest gifts you can give a teacher. Oh, you do that first of all, just to test that. But afterwards, if they pass the test, oh, wonderful. Well done, Hopkin. That's always the best gift you can give to a teacher, to be a good disciple. In other words, to achieve what the teacher wants you to achieve. And that's, you know, that's true. That's how it happens. Ajahn Brahm, I notice once I start focusing on the breath, I swallow a lot. It really is distracting. Should I just let it be or let it happen? All you can actually have if you tend to swallow a lot is put one of these little sweets in the mouth called gobstoppers. Now that's a silly suggestion. No, don't do that. How do you know they just say about swallowing? And part two of this, I'm a sucker for your sales pitch. Yeah, they're suckers. That's why they swallow so much. Could you tell us where to buy your books? Okay. Now, first of all, so whenever you pay attention onto your saliva, then it's a problem. And you have to keep on swallowing. Just right now, can you feel your saliva now? Now it's a problem. But when you weren't paying any attention to it, it just looked after itself quite happily, so much you didn't even know it. Saliva was still being made, it went down, you didn't have to swallow, it's not a big deal because you weren't interfering with it. And this is a very good example, and I often use saliva as an example. When you become mindful of it, you tend to control it. Because when you're not mindful of it, it just goes quite naturally without any problem at all. And this is a difficulty with mindfulness. When you're mindful of something, you interfere with it. And in meditation, you have to learn how to be mindful without controlling, without interfering whatsoever. And if you can learn how to be mindful of your saliva, and it doesn't change how much is generated and how much goes down your throat, exactly the same as when you're not being mindful of it, then you won't know how to be mindful without interfering. That's a tough one. So in the meantime, just take your attention away from the saliva. If you want to swallow, swallow. If you don't, don't. Just be natural. Let the body do what it needs to do. And at the same time, that you just put your attention somewhere else. So don't pay too much attention to the saliva. Put it on your breath, or put it on the nimitta, or put it on loving kindness, or anything. So you're not sort of really worried, and you're not even aware of your saliva. Then it will go in quite naturally. That's what happens. And can you tell us where to buy your books? At the best bookshop in Perth, which is the Buddhist Society of Western Australia bookshop. Also, some of the books are in, those of you who go travelling in the airport at Changi, and I think also Asia Books, the airport's in Thailand. Does it follow from Buddhist ethics that lay people should be vegetarians? There seems to be no advice on meat eating in the suttas for lay people. No, it doesn't. I used to be a vegetarian when I was a lay person, but as soon as I became a monk, I was told that you had to eat whatever you're given. And it was true, because there was not vegetarian food in the northeast of Thailand when I became a monk. It was just gross food. And you know what's coming next? Some of the gross things I used to eat. I always said that frog on rice, that was one of the first gross things we had. This was one meal of the day, no breakfast like we have here. A bowl of sticky rice. No fruits, no vegetables, nothing except a frog on top, like a toad. And it wasn't fried or sautéed with a sprig of garlic. It was just boiled. No salt, no flavour, just a boiled frog. Not gutted, it's just like it jumped into the boiling water itself and someone fished it out and put it on top of your rice. It looked gross and it tasted gross, but that's all you had. That was, you know, your day's food. And that, you know, it's a whole line of monks. This was in Wat Nanachat, about 2 or 3 years. And that's all we had, about 7 or 8 monks, a board of rice and a frog on top. So, like everyone else, you know, you give the blessing, but I must admit the blessing was half-hearted. And then you start to pick at the legs of the frog. There's some meat there. And that was actually okay. But that was not enough to keep you going. So you start picking at the insides of the frog. Now, I said already about having good karma because the fishing story. But I also had good karma because I paid attention at my science classes. So I had an idea of when you're picking the organs, which was which. But the monk sitting next to me obviously had no idea of biology. So when he was picking the organs, he pressed one of the organs, which happened to be the bladder. And that frog still had urine in his bladder. And so the frog peed all over his rice. Now that's a true story. And no matter how hungry you are, you can't eat after that. On another occasion, it was actually frog soup. So frog soup, they weren't the big frogs, they were small frogs. And again, just with rice and frog soup. And the frogs were just a small one, so you know these tiny spoons, you just literally put them on your spoon and put them in the mouth and crunched. And I still remember, I'm not sure it was Monty Python or it was something where they had a comedy skit on crunchy frog. You know, going in a movie theatre, instead of selling ice cream or popcorn, selling crunchy frog. And it was just funny because it was so gross. And here I was actually eating crunchy frog. Because in the Monty Python skit, they said, well, why do you call it crunchy? Because it's still got the bones in it. So that's what we ate. You have to put it in your mouth and just forget about what you're eating. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do it. There's also ant soup, red ants soup, ant eggs, placenta. That was cow placenta. Actually, that was vegetarian food. because sometimes we argued about that. This is when the water buffalo gave birth. It had the placenta left over, and they gave it to you to eat. So it was actually leftovers. It wasn't sort of at the expense of an animal's life. But it's gross. It's really nasty. But that's, you ate anything. Snails, they were really rubbery. It was like eating an eraser. I remember those. So all this gross food. So you can see, I never gave up vegetarian food because of desires. Because you had to. But if you were later, if you've got the choice and you're pretty healthy, then why not? But sometimes you can't handle vegetarian food for some health reason or whatever. But do your very best. At the very least, you can limit your meat eating. Anyway, enough gross stories. Does the Noble Eightfold Path exist in any present-day religion aside from Buddhism? If a Christian priest asked if it exists in Christianity, what would you say? Because the other night you said belief in God means one cannot get to truly liberating insights. Did I say that? Some of you might have said that, but it really depends on what you mean by God. If you say God is truth or peace or love, and you believe in that, if it's an impersonal God, then surely that can be just like metta. You believe in metta, you believe in Dhamma, you believe in Satya, truth. And that's fine, that's not going to be an obstacle. And even if somebody really believed in a God, but they weren't really quite sure what the priests and what the books actually mean by a God, so because they don't really know, they get into these deep meditations, and the experience of these things is so profound that it doesn't matter what you believe before, you pull it outside and you have some truth there. So who knows, maybe you can. You can get into deep meditation. But one of the things you have to be very careful of is to be able to let go of controlling and doing. So any sort of religion or path which is really controlling, 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 that's a very difficult path to get enlightened. And it's letting go, letting things be. So it's not a clear answer, because you can't give a clear answer to that question. Because, you know, I've known, especially living in a country like Australia, there's many different types of Christians. And some of them, I'm surprised they're still allowed to call themselves Christians, some of the things I hear them say. You know, if the archbishops knew about what some of these Christian priests I hang out with say about God or Christianity, you know, I think they'd be excommunicated. But, you know, they're really nice people. Thank you for your compassion and skillful teaching. I have benefited enormously from this retreat, and I'm sure everyone else has too. Can you please give us guidance on continuing practice at home? How often, how long, etc.? Are there any dangers from meditation? Anything we should not do? Anything else we should be aware of? Thank you. It's a very small question, that. But I'll talk about what happens when you get home tomorrow. Because you're not home yet. So that's a question for tomorrow morning. Can you please elaborate more on the four stages of attainment, stream enter, arahat? What is the difference between an arahat and a Buddha? I've already done the difference between an arahat and a Buddha. The different levels. The best simile is given by the Buddha about the shipwrecked sailors. There were 7 shipwrecked sailors. They lost their ship, and there they were in the ocean. And the first shipwrecked sailor was a scallywag, never done much for anybody, and so as soon as he got in the water, he went straight down and drowned. Shipwreck sailor number 2 was the average Joe. Sometimes, you know, he was kind, but sometimes he was cruel. So he went up and down, until he eventually went down and drowned. Shipwreck sailor number 3, he was a really good guy, a good girl, good gay. I've got to be careful. So, he floated because of his good sealer. And the 4th shipwreck sailor was someone who had good virtue, kind, generous. So he also floated, but as he was floating, he looked around. He was floating long enough to look around, he could see dry land, he could see the shore. That's shipwreck sailor number 4. Shipwreck sailor number 5, he had also floated, looked around, seen the shore, and he was swimming to the shore. Shipwreck sailor number 6, he'd been swimming to the shore long enough, now he could stand up in the surf. He could feel the ground underneath him, even though he was still in the waves, just like, you know, on the beach. You're wading to shore. And that was shipwreck sail number 6. And shipwreck sail number 7, he'd already sort of floated, seen the shore, swam to the shore, waded the last few meters, and now was sitting under the coconut tree, eating a coconut, safe, rested, having a good time. And those are Buddha similes. The coconut wasn't in the Buddha similes, I must admit. I always add a little bit, but I do admit where I add things. Shipwreck sailor number 4, the one who's floating because of good virtue, sees the shore, that's the stream winner. You've actually seen what enlightenment is. You've seen the escape from this round of rebirth. You know what to do now. You've seen non-self, you've seen nirvana. So once you've seen it, you become, soon become number 5, you're swimming. You're actually practicing letting go at last, real letting go. You're lessening your cravings and lessening your desires. Now you've seen non-self, it becomes easy to do. You're not afraid of losing something anymore, because you've seen there's nothing to lose. That's the once returner. You're on your way home. Shipwreck sailor number 6. You get so close to nirvana anyway, you can actually stand up, you're waiting to shore. You don't have to swim anymore, it's just easy. That's the anagama, the non-returner. And obviously the one who's actually seen the shore, but swam all the way, waded to shore, now sitting on the dry land, safe, that's the arahat, the enlightened one. That's a very nice simile there, because it shows you that it's actually seeing, you know, these insights, seeing non-self, there's no one in there, seeing that everything is impermanent, even the one which knows comes and goes and is liable to disappear. Now to see the suffering of existence, the suffering of wanting. You know, even wanting, even getting what you want is suffering. And if you're certainly wanting it in the first place, disturbs the peace of your mind. So you see sort of the three characteristics, you know, impermanence, non-self, suffering. You see that, but also you see how to end it. And how it works, the whole process, how it works. And that means you've seen the shore. And obviously, once you've seen the shore, you've got no choice anymore, you swim to the shore. You just can't just sit there in the ocean when you've seen where dry land is, where safety is. That's why when you become a stream winner, that's it. 7 lifetimes at most, you can't stop that. You have to sort of go swimming to the shore, and you get to the shore eventually. And the closer you are, if you're really close, non-returner, if you're sitting on the shore, that's the fully enlightened one. Is that okay? Very good, next question. Ajahn, you said if we let all these stages come naturally, but it also seems from reading the basic method that we train in these stages. Please explain, do we practice contentment or train in the stages? Yeah, remember that's a basic method of meditation, but you have gone past the basic stage. You're not basic meditators anymore, I hope, after 9 days. So you don't need to sort of like force it. The contentment is the best way. So do the contented way. Don't be basic. Dear Ajahn Brahm, a couple of nights ago you dismissed the experience of Bhavanga on the basis that it is scientifically impossible. I think the main reason I dismissed it is because it was not the teaching of the Buddha. It came in afterwards. Question 1. Was the basis that the bioscience shows the brain's sensory capacity to be limited to the outer surface of the body? Oh my goodness. If so, any young bioscientist would acknowledge that it doesn't explain the vibrational energetic sensation that most of us feel inside our hands and feet. Bioscience has no explanation for that sort of subtle sensory experience inside the body. Question 2. Whatever scientific basis you use to dismiss Bhavanga, how logical is it to say that an experience in meditation cannot be real because it defies scientific reasoning? The jhanas and all resulting psychic powers also defy scientific reason, but those who have experienced them know they are true. I don't think, did I really say that I dismissed Bhavanga on the basis of science? What did I say?
Well, you said because you can't experience subatomic particles.
Oh, the subatomic particles bit, yeah. Yeah. Aha, there we go. There comes an expert. Thank you. Because you're a bioscientist, weren't you?
Neuroscience.
Neuroscience, yeah. Yeah. But if I understand Bhavanga correctly, And it's not so much from science. I just was pointing out science cannot know subatomic particles. But pointing out that I think the Bawanga, the idea was a reason why the concept was invented, because sometimes you have five khandhas, the basic constituents of a being, if you like, coming and going. Sometimes when they go, when they pause, when they stop, they say, well, where do they go to? They must be stored up somewhere, because energy can't be destroyed. So where is it when it's not apparent? And so it's almost as if they're stored in this storehouse, the constituents of existence, the bawa anga. And therefore, because it's stored there, it can arise afterwards. So it explains moments of unconsciousness. Now, where do the five khandhas go when you are under anesthetic? For example, you're totally unconscious. And you can put a machine on you to show you're unconscious, nothing's working. And clear mindfulness afterwards says you were not aware. But so where does your awareness go? And I think the Abhidharma had the idea you can't just destroy these things just and they come up again afterwards. Therefore they have to be go somewhere, and the repository became the Bawanga. Basically that was the idea.
That was more of an explanation.
An explanation, yes.
That could explain
the jhana. Yeah, to actually, well, jhana, you're actually still experiencing things there. But it was because of the Abhidharma method, then they had to sort of use that method to interpret the suttas, rather than use the teaching of the Buddha to interpret the Abhidharma. The Abhidharma became this whole framework which was put onto the word of the Buddha and squeezed the Buddha this way and that way. Another thing, like in the Abhidharma, they say that this thing, paths and fruits, being on the path to being a stream winner, and the fruit of stream winning, the path of being a once returner, and the fruits of being a once returner, and same with Anagami and Arahat. And it's quite clear from the sutras that the path, actually when you're on a process which is certainly going to lead to that result, actually precedes the result for sometimes years and years. But the Abhidharma say, no, it can't be that way. As soon as the path is, the fruit is a moment, a tiny mind moment afterwards. Because they had to have that because of the way they imposed their theory upon the Buddha's teachings. And that's counter how the Buddha taught. So, see, the Abhidharma method was like a theory which was imposed on the Buddha after the time of the Buddha. And it messed up a lot of things. So that's why another, if anyone is interested in this, the best book is Professor A.K. Waters, Indian Buddhism, because he is not a Buddhist. When I went to Toronto it was about 2 or 3 months ago, I think, just before, in June, July. And I was asking about him, because that's where he lived, and many of the Buddhists over there, they knew him, they said, do you want to have dinner with him or something? But, you know, I don't have dinner and a very full program, didn't really have time, but I really respect what he wrote. And they know him over there because he's written many books about Buddhism, but he's not a Buddhist. He doesn't believe in rebirth. He claims he's not a Buddhist. But he wrote this wonderful book, Indian Buddhism. The whole purpose of the book was, what did the Buddha teach and what didn't he teach? And not coming from a partisan standpoint about being Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, but using science, logic, reason, doing things like analysis of language. If I gave you a book, or if I quoted Chaucer, and then I quoted Shakespeare, and then I quoted Charles Dickens, and then I quoted Harry Potter, you'd soon be able to figure out which book was written earlier and which book was written later. It's because language changes, vocabulary changes, you can actually date passages, you know, within 10 or 20 years usually, by comparing to other passages which are well known. So this is linguistic analysis. It was developed because they wanted to date passages from the Christian Bible, and they can use this on Buddhist texts. So they can actually use this to find out what was early, what was later. And they can use the way that poetry, because there's many poems, many verses in the Buddha's sutras, and actually the verses, the type of verses, the meter would change know, sometimes one particular meter would be popular, then it would sort of fall out of fashion and become more complicated. It developed, evolved. So that was another way they could actually find out when these things were written. So he did a whole book, very, very well researched, basically just about almost the final word, to actually to date the different strata of Buddhist works. Abhidharma comes out quite late. Now, I get into trouble with that. I remember actually have people in Toronto actually wrote to me afterwards, or someone told me, because I went up there and said, Buddha never taught Abhidharma, came later. And afterwards, all the Sri Lankans met together over there and said, it can't be right. No, Ajahn Brahm was wrong. The Buddha did teach Abhidharma, so they felt happy again. So, but if you look at the reason, be rational, look at the evidence. Don't just say because, you know, our teacher said. Look it up for yourself, and it's very clear. Okay, Meta.
There's a book called Buddhist Psychology.
Yeah.
David.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably have. That rings a bell. But this is actually the Buddhist history. And actually this was a professor of Pali Sanskrit all his life in Cambridge. And this guy really knew his stuff. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you have to be sort of quite... This is one of the nice things about being a Westerner. Just because it's your tradition... You will not just accept it just because it's your tradition, just because your teacher said so. You would not accept it. It has to have some foundation, some reason there. So even though it's a bit heretical for me to say things like that, but you know, I've got enough reputation now that I can say heretical things without being thrown out. Anyway, let's get on. Does one need to reincarnate again in order to attain nirvana? Say if you died just achieving deep meditation first jhana. Can a layperson with family and children attain nirvana? People always want to have their cake and eat it, as they say. Both sides. But first of all, do you have to get reborn to be able to get nirvana? Obviously, you don't need to get reborn if you really practice well. And if you don't achieve jhana, who knows, you might just do it at your last breath, or just after the breath, when you die. So give it the best you've got, and obviously by meditating here and just by doing well, you're increasing your chances of throwing a lucky throw of the dice at the end, if not beforehand. However, if you don't make it in this life, then you get reborn again. Obviously you get reborn, you don't lose everything you've done in this life. It's there for you as your inclination in your next life. So the chances are you just take off where you left off from this life. And then you'll continue meditating and getting deeper. Who knows, maybe your next life you might do it. But anyway, why are Western people in such a rush? This life, next life, another life. Just do as best you can. You can't do faster than that. But can, with a family, can you become enlightened? Certainly you can become a stream winner. Even once returner. Look at Gatikara. He was an anagami, a non-returner. But if you're a non-returner and you're living in a family, there's some things you just cannot do. No more sex. So be careful. Do you really want to be a non-returner? Remember, I know family life. Sometimes, be careful, you realize what's going to happen when you do become enlightened. And also, another interesting thing with Gatikara, he would have no money, even if he was a lay person. Because what he would do, he'd put his pots on the shelf outside his hut, and he'd leave a sign that anyone wants to take a pot, just help yourself. Wouldn't sell anything. And he said, if you want to leave some rice and lentils, for me and my mum and dad, just leave some rice and lentils. Like barter, without any prices. That was a marvellous. That's what an anagami is like. So they're not really concerned with the world. If you want it, take it. Now that's, you can see, just the high-mindedness of an anagami. So if you're at home, an anagami, you can actually test whether you're really a non-returner during the stock market crash. Oh, never mind. It comes and goes. If the bank wants to take the whole lot, you can take the whole lot, come on. So you're not really concerned about these things. So that's a test. So that's what it's like if you're enlightened at home. But usually, if you are enlightened, or you get that way, so why not become a monk or a nun? You don't want to watch the TV, you're not concerned about the stock market, you know, you're just no concern about sex. It makes more fun being a monk, because that's where you belong. Are the precepts only about actions on the external world, for instance, in using harsh inner speech against yourself? Precept number 4. Or having a violent, angry attitude towards yourself and your mistakes, precept number 1. Considered forms of breaking precepts at a more than metaphysical but actual karmic level. Here I have been thinking, I have been pretty good at keeping the 5 precepts, but if they also include these internal actions, I actually may not. Well, I suppose this is more incentive to be kinder to myself. Okay, have you been breaking your inner precepts? If so, you can never be a member of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And we'll use the mind police. I will read your minds to see whether you qualify. Of course you don't do things like that. And even the Buddha said sort of the mental karma, in this particular sense, is a bit less. Because you can think all sorts of crazy thoughts, but as long as you don't put them into speech or put them into action. And sometimes that is the case. Sometimes one of the reasons I don't ring the gong anymore to sort of start the meditation, end the meditation. I gave one retreat at Sydney, and at the end of the retreat, this woman said, well, I had a love-hate relationship with you, Ajahn Brahm. Mostly hate. If you're a teacher, you're in big trouble sometimes. You say, I've got all this control over you, because sometimes, he said, you rang that bell, and I was having such a good meditation, now I had to get up. I'm sure you did it 5 minutes too early. I hated you for that. I said, sometimes I was in such pain and agony and you rang the bell 5 minutes late. I hated you for that. So I couldn't win ringing the bell either way. But never mind. She had those thoughts. Like everybody has weird thoughts when you're meditating. But don't worry, that's not breaking your precepts. As long as you restrain the body and the speech, you're okay. I better carry on. There's lots of questions. And it's the last day. Question for Sister Satima. What advice can you give to us for this path of cessation?
That was yesterday. We left it for you.
Well, there you go. That's Sister Satima's advice for cessation. She leaves it for you. How do we... There we go, that's right. How do we know we're not controlling? Okay, you know you're not controlling when you don't write any questions, when they write themselves. You know you're not controlling because things get very still and very peaceful, because control disturbs the stillness. No control enhances the stillness. So if you're getting more and more still, no controlling. Ajahn, when sleepy or restless, is it better to do a walking meditation rather than persisting with sitting meditation? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Best actually to do nothing. If you're sitting, carry on sitting. If you're walking, carry on walking. If you get very sleepy when you're walking, sleepwalk. No, whatever you want to do, it's not really important. Either way is good. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can a nimitta be a black shining disc surrounded by a rim of bright orange light like an eclipse with a black background? Thank you. A psychedelic nimitta. Yeah, it can be anything you like. Yep, that will qualify. Ajahn, can you please explain the benefits of chanting? Is chanting in Pali seen as being more efficacious? No, it's just something we do to pass the time between morning and evening. Except if you understand the chant, can be very inspiring. Or sometimes that chanting can be very powerful, and this is for ghost busting. Our chanting, from the forest tradition is the most powerful for driving away ghosts. Because you've heard our chanting. It's so bad that no self-respecting ghost can stand it. They hear me chant, they run a mile. Ah! Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you and all the monks and nuns for making this retreat such a beautiful experience. May all be healthy, happy, peaceful and content. Question. Where to from here? Nowhere. This is a road to nowhere. Next question. Dear Ajahn, I asked you this question during interview but forgot the yes-no answer. Please forgive me for not asking again, or for asking again. Could the body still disappear if we don't watch a particular object, but neither stay still and feel it getting more peaceful? You then gave the beautiful simile of the lake stealing when we don't put our hand in it, but I forgot if it is possible for senses to disappear with this approach, or if we eventually need to focus attention on a particular object. Okay, it's hard for the senses to disappear unless you focus on one object. It's like, can you jump over the stream from one side to the other? In other words, you have all the five senses and you can just completely let them go all in one shot. That's difficult to do. So the usual method is to have one of the senses, a particular part of one of the senses, as your stepping stone from five sense experience to no sense experience, or rather just the sixth sense, the mind. So that stepping stone is something like the breath, or like a nimitta, a visual object. You know, the breath is a physical object. So just one physical object which you focus on to the exclusion of everything else, just by doing letting go, not through will and force, and then everything else falls away. You've only just got your breath in mind, and that gets soft, and then that disappears. This is why those stepping stones across the river are very useful. Sure, it can be done other ways, but why try and get your own new original, never been done before, so you can patent it way, when the Buddha has done this before and other people have done this before? It's a well-worn road, and being a well-worn road is the best road.
Okay, but to take that a little further then, if it is better to focus on one thing,
yeah,
that's better than to not focus on one thing.
Yeah.
Would it not be better then to narrow down the area of awareness so that
yes. Yeah.
Place on where the breath is touching.
Okay. Yeah. To narrow down the awareness is very useful, but if you narrow it down on a part of the body, as if once you've got one part of the body, of the physical body, especially on the skin, you're very open to other feelings in the body coming in. The feeling of the breath is different than the feeling of the body. It's got its own little feeling. It's not the nose feeling, it's the breath feeling. And that's why I find it very useful personally in teaching others to what I call disembody the breath as soon as possible. So you know the breath is going in, you know the breath is going out, but you haven't got a clue where on the body it's located. So thereby, if you're letting go of as much as a physical bodily feeling, you've just got the feeling of the breath. And the feeling of the breath is not really located anywhere.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But then I can still actually feel it in my abdomen, so I was focusing on that because my logic was, well, then it's still not my mind knowing, I can still feel it. But what you're suggesting is better to not focus on something like that.
Best to focus on the breath, but don't focus on the body. And it's the simile was like if you're like a CIA or ACO operative and you're following a suspected terrorist. And you don't just follow the terrorist into the places he usually hangs out. If he's a man and he goes into women's toilets, you have to follow him in there. Wherever he goes, even though he's not supposed to be in there, that's where you have to follow them. So it's the same as sometimes people looking for Ajahn Brahm in Bodhinyana Monastery today. They won't find me there. I'm supposed to be there, but I'm not. I'm here. So sometimes, if you look at the tip of the nose, sometimes the breath's not there. If you look at the abdomen, sometimes it's not there. But I can always know it somewhere. Close my eyes. Am I breathing in? Am I breathing out? I know I'm breathing in. But the extra perception, I'm breathing in, and that feeling is located here, there, or whatever. That extra perception, I've paid no attention to at all.
So you're really going for the knowing as soon as possible.
The knowing of the breath as soon as possible. But it's not really mental knowing yet, because that's a physical feeling. But you're sort of simplifying it of its location on your body. The location in your body part, you don't pay attention to. You just know it's going in. It's a breath, it's a feeling. So that simplifies it. Okay. Yeah. It's getting narrower. Yeah. So it is a narrowing of attention. But it's also, because the breath becomes very still. Now, it happens, I haven't mentioned this, but it's probably in the books. It's going in, it's going out. After a while, there's no difference between the in and the out breath. It's just breath. So actually, even the idea of going in, going out, or middle, beginning, end, just disappears. You just know it's breath. And because it's a feeling which doesn't change, that's why it disappears. You've got to have something which is stable, unchanging, for it to disappear and fade away. Because the brain, the sensory experience, cannot notice things which are always there. Even sound, like the old sound, the hum of the traffic in the background, it's always been there. Because it doesn't change, you can't notice it. But you know, there's someone honks their horn, then you can know it. Yes, the breath disappears, because there's nothing's changing, narrowed down. So the physical feelings, the five senses are now all gone. So you've got the mind, and from there the nimitta can come up. Wow, we're going to be late tonight. Do nothing, yeah, you got it. Just wait and see what happens. If the nimitta is right for it to come, it will come. If it's too early, it will just disappear. So you just be passenger. For Ajahn Brahmavamsa, what is the latest age someone could be accepted as a novice by the monasteries here in Australia? It really depends how desperate we are for people to help out. And of course it makes a lot of difference if you're a millionaire and give all your money to the nuns' monastery before you become a nun. No, it does not. No, that if you're old, it's not your age, but sort of your health is important. So if you're really sort of looking for like an old people's home, but with, you know, nice monks and nuns, rather than one of these places where you have to pay a lot of money for, you don't get such good attention. Obviously, you can look somewhere else. But, you know, if you're reasonably healthy, and as I say, you're not going to be a burden on the rest of the community. So you haven't got some great illnesses which people will have to look after. I remember this happened in Ajahn Sumedho's monastery. I mean, there was a very nice elderly woman, and she had been looking after the monks and the nuns for quite a few years, and when she got really bedbound and she had no one else to look after them, she was living alone, they said, "Oh, you come live in the monastery," and they started looking after her. But it was 24-hour care, and the nuns really started to complain that they were compassionate, but they actually became nuns, you know, to become enlightened, to do some meditation. It was just so draining of all their time and energy, all the other things they had to do as well. And they said, "Please, Ajahn Sumedho, you gave her permission, but we're the ones who have to do the work. So I have to actually ask my monks, if somebody wants to become a monk and they're very old, is this okay? But look at their health, are they going to be a burden on everybody?" And if they're reasonably healthy, obviously, there'd be no problem. You know, like we've got, for example, Ekagata, you know, he's, how old is he now? 67, yeah, and he's only just 5 years. So he's a day when he's in his 60s. But he's really healthy, and a very fit guy, even though he's quite old. So people like that, no problem at all. So it really depends. But, to give you hope, there was a man in the time of the Buddha who ordained as a monk at the age of 120 years. And after ordaining, a couple of months later, he became fully enlightened. He became an arahant. and about a month later he passed away. Or within about 3 months, ordaining, becoming enlightened and passing away. He left it to the last moment, but he managed just to fit it in before he passed away. Not to be recommended. Dear Jabram, how do you get rid of attachments, e.g. movies, food, especially attachments to children? Don't have children. However you got them already, once they've grown up, remember they're not your children. They came with karma from the past. They're old beings even when they pop out of your womb. So, are they really yours? And anyway, you know, once you know they get to 18, 19, 20, they don't want you around anyway. So great! Thank you, kids. Bye-bye. You're going to have to come home again. You can look after yourself from here on in. Just like the birds. You see birds in the forest. They look after their little chicks with so much attention. They feed them all day with worms. They go without themselves. Think of the poor mother. You think you've got a sore bottom meditating all day. Imagine sitting on those round eggs. They don't have zafus to sit on. They can't put their legs out in the small nest or go to bed and sleep when they're tired. So they have to, imagine the sore bum those birds have after many days sitting on those eggs and looking after them. And then they have to teach the birds how to fly. But as soon as the birds can fly, that's it. Won't see you again, kids. Off you go. Mum and Dad has a nice time. So you should be like the birds. As soon as your kids are okay, and as soon as, you know, not say okay. Sometimes with Mum and Dad, their kids are never okay. 40, 50, 60 years of age, and you're still looking after them. So as soon as your kids have finished university or whatever, okay, off you go. And I'm going to the temple. See you later. So, to the husband, now you're really looking at difficulties. Find him a nice young floozy. Say, off you go, husband. Now I can actually leave you, drop you now. I never said that, okay. This morning, whilst enjoying my meditation, a concern arose that I might miss my lunch. I continue meditating though, telling myself if I don't get out in time for lunch, the meditation will be really good or worthwhile. After some time, I heard a single crapping sound and got out of my meditation. A short while later, just in time to enjoy my lunch. Could this have been a Davis crap? Can you tell us more about Davis? Nah, Davis don't crap. They would leave you alone. And anyway, I should have told people before. But if you have a deep jhana and you miss your lunch, then I will get the establishment here to go and buy you whatever food you want in the evening. You can break your precepts after jhana if you want. But really what would happen is that if you got a jhana, you would not be hungry at all. Just the bliss of the jhana is more delicious than the rice and the curry or the potatoes and the pasta, whatever else we have. It's more delicious. So I guarantee if you get a jhana and you miss your lunch, you'll have no regrets. So just go for it. So somebody clapping, I don't know who was clapping, probably sort of somebody clopping with their feet rather than clapping with their hands. More likely. But it doesn't matter, he came out. That's good enough. Devas will leave you alone. Sometimes I may sit for 2 to 3 hours and feel I was very mindful and focused. After I come out of the meditation, I will feel that mindfulness energy carries over. But not long after, even half an hour or something, it seems to wear off and I find myself lost in thinking or getting annoyed at something again. Does it mean that meditation sitting was not all that focused or still after all? Quite likely it wasn't that still. It was still good, but it can be more still because the stiller you are, the more energy which comes up, the longer it lasts. So sometimes you get, say, into a jhana, deep meditation, that lasts for days. You just can't get angry at anything. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I love your jokes and your clever ways of using them to teach Dharma, but... oops. How do you relate your really bad jokes with Samawaja? Well, everybody sort of makes mistakes. I just let go and don't feel guilty. Could you please explain the right speech in more detail and its effect on enlightenment? What positive and negative effects are there in those bad jokes towards enlightenment? Oh, that's a tough question. But, you see, just even Ajahn Chah would tell jokes, and even some of the great monks would tell jokes. And that actually asks, why do they tell jokes? Because look, you've been meditating a long time, and sometimes at the end of the day you're a bit tired. And a little bit of humour sometimes gives you a boost of energy, and it also means you don't take yourself so seriously anymore, you're letting go of the sense of self. So they are directed to lift you, to give you energy, and also to keep you going, because otherwise the retreat will be really boring, and after a while you get fed up. I tell jokes also to get your attention, like in Nolamara, sometimes you're giving a talk, and you see people, their heads go down, that's the time to tell a joke. And then people's heads go up, and after they laugh at the joke, they pay attention to you for another 10 minutes. So it's a teaching tool. That's why it is samawaja, because the purpose is to allow people to listen to Dharma, to understand Dharma, and to relax and become enlightened. So remember, karma is all about intention. Not so much what you do, but why you're doing it. That's my excuse anyway. Dear Ajahn Brahm, will you be selling copies of your well-known book, Open the Door, at the end of the retreat, with a discount? Oh dear. And can we get autographed copies? Yeah, if you autograph, that costs the 2 cents discount. Now, did anyone bring any? I think they're over in Olamara. Have we got any here? I don't know. Because we're not like a sales place. So if you want them, you get some in Olamara. Or if you're not sort of living in Perth, you can actually get them in Changi Airport, Asia Books in Thailand, internet, yeah. Or you find them somewhere. Thank you, Bianca, and the wonderful volunteers who offered the delicious meals. I am grateful to you for your time, energy, money, and most of all, your generosity. May you all be well, healthy, and happy. Metta. Very good. Because without them, you know, we'd have to be looking for something to eat, tidying up and everything. So it's wonderful always to have gratitude to the people who make this retreat place possible, including the Catholics who let us make use of this, and all the people who built it. But we'll do a gratitude meditation tomorrow afternoon. I should actually mention that we finish around about 3 o'clock tomorrow, so there'll be another talk from 8 till 9, and then the usual meditation, but no interviews tomorrow. I've got to go to one of the disciples, one of the old committee members, from our BSWA is getting married tomorrow, so I have to go and do a little blessing for them. So I'll miss the lunch here, they'll get me something over there. And we come back for, everyone comes from a meditation between 2 to 3, and we start at 2 o'clock, and somewhere about 2:30 we do a little metta meditation. I'll lead that, so we finish off at 3 o'clock. And at 3 o'clock, when we all finish, I just pass, only then should you pack your bags. How many of you have already packed your bags? And it's not even Sunday yet. You have plenty of time to pack your bags afterwards, but don't pack your bags until we're all finished. Dear Ajahn, having listened to your profound teachings, I'm so much more determined to practice. Could you give us an insight as to why some of the Ajahn Chah's early disciples disrobed after many years? Can't understand why, how they could go back to the lay jungle. Thank you for your teaching. It's fascinating that sometimes if you're a monk and not getting any peace or satisfaction in meditation of all things, sometimes you think, why should I be a monk? This is actually one of the teachings of the Buddha. He said, if you don't get deep meditation in your monastic life, if you don't get real happiness, then obviously you'll look for the only other place you can find happiness, which is in the world with sex, marriage, children, or whatever, movies or whatever. If you get lots of happiness with meditation, then you don't want those things. Remember, a person becomes a monk or a nun, sure that they come in with the best intentions, but sometimes it doesn't work out, and the meditation doesn't really take off. And sometimes it can be a very hard life as a monk or nun. And that's why we allow people to disrobe. They're not happy being a monk or a nun, it's best that they leave. We don't want unhappy people. Just because they're a monk or a nun doesn't mean they have to stay for a monk or a nun for the rest of their life. Give it a try. If it works out, you're happy, things are going well, fine, stay. If it doesn't work out, never mind, you gave it a good shot. You can come back again later on. Dear Ajahn Brahm, will you be giving us some instruction and guidance on meditating? When we go home, yes, tomorrow, because you've not gone home yet. You said during question and answers the other night that an experience of non-self and the letting go intends, also in a jhana, eventually fades away. How soon, like a few hours, days, week after that experience? Does one have to keep experiencing jhanas many, 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 many times before the understanding of non-self really sinks in? Are we talking hundreds of times, or less, or more? That must be written by an accountant. Did I get it right? Anyway, yeah, you do get experience of non-self in a jhana, depending how deep that jhana is, how powerful that experience, but it does fade away. But eventually when you get the insight based on that experience, that becomes a permanent seeing. So, you know, the jhanas give you a seeing of non-self, but if you really understand that with an insight, then that makes you a stream winner, once return, and those are the things which last. So the jhanas give you the possibility, the insights give you the permanence, as it were, of insight. Thank you, thank you, thank you for a truly wonderful, inspiring retreat. May you be all well happy. Very good. I like fan mail. Do the monks get any training at Bodhinyana Monastery? I hope so. What sort of question is that? No, carry on. For example, do they learn Pali, study the sutras, etc.? When the nuns get training, what kind of training will they get? Some monks are really very, very good with their head, and so for those monks, you teach them Pali. But it's voluntary. In other words, there's some people are just not that inclined for a language like Pali. So you're not looked upon as being a second-class monk if you don't go to the Pali classes. But you know, if you want to, that's on offer there. The same as sutras. Some people really love the sutras, and they study, and they say, Ajahn Brahmali, he knows the sutras better than I do. So he's an expert on those things. But other people, they can just meditate, and they get a deeper understanding than even sort of reading the sutras, and that's fine also. And some monks like to be teachers, some administrators, some like to sort of mix concrete. And they do a great service over there. So I remember just there was one monk in Thailand once, and he was actually asked by a newspaper. He'd been in Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, for about 6 or 7 years. He said, what have you learned after 6 or 7 years living in Wat Pa Phong? He said, I know how to mix concrete now. It was a bit of a joke, but there was some truth to it as well. So yeah, and the nuns training, so obviously you make use of a person's qualities, so you don't, you know, try to fit everybody into the same sort of mould and get all the nuns to be Pali scholars, Vinaya scholars, jhana meditators, teachers, administrators, or mixing concrete. See, you know, Sister Satama is a bit past mixing concrete now. But this one isn't. So we have to make use of what we've got. Dirajan, I have read that it is possible as a layperson to achieve attainment, such as Sotapanna or Anagami. If a layperson is bound to their lay life by social or financial responsibilities or constraint, how should they structure their lives to best go about it? Okay, to unstructure, unbind your lay life to social or financial responsibilities. In other words, if you're not married yet, then don't get married. Just dump your girlfriend. You have more time to meditate. It's really nice that over here in Perth, you see some of these little guys growing up, you know, the little kids when they first come up, and one of the guys, about last year, he had got his first girlfriend. But you know, he was studying at university, and he was working, I think, in KFC or something to get some money, and he was actually saving up, and he came up to me, and it's so sad, he said, having a girlfriend is so much suffering. I had so much money before I met her. Now it's all gone. And he's only 18. So dump the girlfriend, dump the boyfriend. If you really want companionship, get a cat or a dog. Well, budgerigar is cheaper. doesn't sort of take so much money. And that we can be simple. As for your financial responsibilities, downsize. And if you come and see how big a house you want, come and look at my cave. So that means you can actually have a small house. You don't need the big houses. You don't need to have the beautiful views. If you want a nice view in your sort of apartment, get a big photograph of Cottesloe Beach and paste it on your paste it on your roof. That doesn't have to be in the best suburb. It doesn't have to be sort of a big house. So downsize, get a small apartment in sort of in what it Balgo or somewhere. Nice and cheap. Or even better, Armidale. That's the southernmost suburb of Byford. One of the southernmost suburbs of Perth. It's close to the monastery. And this house is really cheap down there. So you can downsize, move close to the monastery, which means that you don't have to work so hard. And you can give away your TV. You don't need a big, what's it called, the LCDs. Is it LCDs? The big LCD TV screens. As I tell you, the only reason you have those big TV screens is to impress visitors. So give it away, and if you want a TV, you can have a tiny one, like on the back of the Singapore Airlines. Or no TV, it's even better. So, I mean, you can actually live very frugally with hardly, you know, not much money if you really want to. So that way you can lessen your financial problems, and you can be inoculated against the financial crash. You know, when you don't have much outgoings of money, because you live very simply and frugally. So it can be done. So that's a very nice thing for people to do. You don't need a car, get a bicycle. You can bicycle up the hill to Bodhinyana Monastery with your daughter. No, maybe that's going a bit too fast. So anyway, you can do something. Anyway, the last question, because it's getting very, very late. This is the last question of the whole retreat. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in this tradition, does a teacher choose his or her students? Oh, if only. No, I get dumped with students. I don't have many choice. Or does the student choose the teacher? And does the student need to make a formal request to the teacher? In other words, if I am not a monk or a nun and I live in another part of the country and I would like you to be my teacher, how do I go about that? I've got too many disciples. Have compassion on me. And anyway, as a teacher, as I've told you many, many, many times, a teacher, what's the job of a teacher? To get rid of disciples. So the last 8 days, I've been trying so hard to get rid of you. To make you disappear. Vanish. So you don't have to come to a retreat anymore. You've got jhanas, you've got enlightened, so you don't need to come back again. A good teacher is one who gets rid of his disciples or her disciples very quickly. So I know that some of you have been coming back. How many years, John, have you been coming to these retreats? Suwadi, Ming, Rodney. I must be a terrible teacher. You have to keep coming back and again. Imagine if I was like teaching, so grade one at school, and you were coming back, how many years? I would lose my position. So I must be a terrible teacher that people keep coming back again. So remember, the real teacher is not a monk or a nun. The teacher is your life. Your meditation is your great teacher. So please, your main teacher is what you can see and understand in your heart. The teachers are just there to help a little bit. The main teacher is your own experience. So please remember that. And actually, for any guidance you need, you can find everything you want, all my teachings and the jokes you can find in Open the Door of Your Heart, Marvelous Bliss and Beyond, and if not, on the internet. So your teacher, from now on, is Ajahn Website. But nevertheless, and I'll try and give as much advice as I possibly can. But there is a limit to how many letters you can write, and on purpose you don't have email. So don't ask me for my email number. Because if I did, actually I have got email now, but we'd actually checked it on the weekend, there's nothing there on my email. It's very good. Exactly. So you're not going to get it out of me. So people keep asking, why do you have email? I said, well, I have email. So I've answered all their questions. I'm compassionate. I just don't give it out. So anyway, so there is the question so far. But you notice the questions, some of them are fun and games. Some of them are just a little bit of insight. Some answer the questions. But the only way to really answer all the questions is your own personal experience. So even though this is the last opportunity for questions, there's a lot of opportunity for answering those questions when you put them in your mind and you see how those questions can be answered. And all the meditation questions from your experience. That's how I answered my questions. Trying, experimenting, see what works. See how the whole mind gets still. And once you see how it gets still, ah, now I know what to do. And that's the best way. You and your experience is by far the greatest teacher. Your Ajahn, your teacher, lives inside. So you can carry your teacher with you. So you're a disciple of Ajahn meditation, of Ajahn insight. And that lives with you wherever you go. Does that wash? Whatever, anyway. You'll try, okay. So, that's the last question. So, have a nice evening. The night is still young. And remember to get up early, or even better, don't go to bed, because when did the Buddha become enlightened? What time of day? When do most people become enlightened? It's amazing that dawn is a magic time. When the sun rises, the first light arises in the eastern sky. That is a magic time. So if you haven't got enlightened yet, it's probably because you're always in bed at that time. So, tomorrow is your chance. So, only one last day. So get up early tomorrow morning, or even best don't go to bed. Or you just get up, set your alarm for dawn, get up, see if it works, and then go to bed afterwards. Okay, so anyway, have a nice night. See you tomorrow.